Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, the Federal Reserve. You have a folder in your resources tab in ReggieNet that says the Federal Reserve. In there is a link to a document that will summarize what I'm saying. You also have a short video that is done by the Federal Reserve that kind of gives it gives a nice overview, although it is kind of cheesy. It's an animated video, but it does go through the basics of the Federal Reserve, and this will be the lecture in which I talk about that and go through some interesting aspects of the Fed. But a quick look here at the markets, just to have a look at what's going on. We have a down day. It's not a nasty down day. It's just a sour day down. That we got the Dow down about 0.2, S&P down more, of course, 0.28, and then the NASDAQ, the typical pattern. It's down the most, the greatest risk and the greatest return, up or down. So there you go. It's not a horrible day. Interestingly, here we go with crude oil. It's going to punch 110 a barrel. As I told you, it was not going to put up with staying low. Oddly enough, though, interesting, that there is oil on the high seas. No question about it that the Russians are getting their oil out, even though there are sanctions. There are countries buying it. That oil is out there, but oddly, we still have the price going up because there are restrictions on the supply in the channels and at the ports of entry, and so it's going to keep finding its way up. Like I said, right now the goal is 125 a barrel. It's going to find it one way or the other, maybe not next week or the week after that, but it's on its way back up again. So those lower prices at the gas pump are going to turn around here in the next few days, I would imagine. But there you go. So in other words, investors are getting out of equities. They're selling the equities. Where's the money going? Well, there's metals. Silver is having a strong up day. Well, that's interesting. Now, bonds are down. The yields are up 3 basis points, which means prices are down. So investors are getting out of stocks. They're getting out of bonds. Looks like a little of that money's going into some metals. The rest is going into cash. So it's a defensive day. It's not any kind of signal of disaster on the horizon. It's just not a very fun day. And then, interestingly, London rose through the day, and it's just finishing up now, and it's on an upward slope. The Nikkei was down in the early trading, but it was tried to climb back, but it never did find positive daylight. So all things considered, the looks like the markets in the United States are in just kind of a sour mood right now. No big good news, and so the bad news that they're harboring is going to affect their decisions for the time being. A little mention here. Well, let me do this. Have a quick look at the yield curve. Oh, boy. That notch, the inversion, has settled itself to the 710, and it's still a 1 basis point inversion. Now, all of the rates, as you can see, the rates are going up. Interest rates are going up. We are trying to stop the inflation, probably a little later than we should have, but interestingly enough, as I was showing in my international finance course this morning, other countries in the world are not, there's inflation around the world. It's a problem because countries were printing money to get through this difficult time that we had over the last year and a couple of years. But other countries are not yet ready to start raising their interest rates as aggressively as we are. So that is going to do first thing is our interest rates going up, that's going to push us toward a recession. Second thing is, as our interest rates go up, the value of the dollar goes up against other currencies, so that kills our exports. and makes it so that we buy more imports. So it's not the best thing. It's a bad cure, but it is the only real cure for a problem with inflation, which we have. We're facing it before other countries are, so yay for us, even though we'll feel the pain first, but we'll get out of the pain faster than before other countries do. So that's the good news on that side of it. I want to take you on a journey, and I'm going to finish one last little piece of this on Wednesday with a picture. But for today, and I also want to talk a little more about investing on Wednesday before I get into ethics, which is Wednesday and Friday. But for today, this is about the Federal Reserve. Central bank would be a bank that was sort of like the large bank that oversaw or in some way was the leader of all the banks of a country. Now, oddly enough, even in the 1600s and the 1700s, we saw the start of central banks in Europe. They weren't a central bank by declaration, but they were sort of getting the control over the money of the economy and the banking system of the economy. This was in the 1700s. You saw these Germanic lands. You saw it in other parts, in France and places like that, that central bank concept coming about. The world was getting really complicated even then, and banking was getting much more complex, and there was more opportunity for fraud in banking on a large scale that would have hurt the economy. There were more opportunities for capital investment as we went around the world and conquered lands and found new things. And the Industrial Revolution was building steam with steam engines, oddly enough. And so it was a time when their mature economies, the economies of Western civilization, needed to have that central bank to take control of things. By the 1800s, Europe was fully, the countries had central banks. So, well, this is our central bank. It handles money matters, financial institutions are overseen, such things as that. The money supply is run through the central bank. And the United States wanted nothing to do with it. The young country had no interest whatsoever in some government control of something. The federal government was just not going to be permitted to have that kind of authority. As a matter of fact, if you lived in the United States in the pre-Civil War era, you would never have heard someone say, the United States. They would have said, these United States. States' rights were everything. And the idea of the central government was this government here in Washington, D.C., but doesn't affect us. And to the extent that it does, it had a really negative perception in a lot of parts of the country. As a matter of fact, I have relatives, long ancestor relatives, down in Kentucky and Tennessee. To this day, they hate the federal government. And there are places you would not want to go down there if you were a Fed, because they'd probably kill you down in that part of the country, because Washington and his whiskey cronies, they're in... George and his whiskey cronies had sent out these revenuers, and they were smashing up the stills all over the place in around Pennsylvania, down in Kentucky and Tennessee, and no one saw the central government as being much of anything other than a problem. So there wasn't going to be much idea of a central bank here. As a matter of fact, there was a central bank tried twice in the early 1800s. And the second time, it actually took hold, a second national bank, I think it was. And it actually started acquiring deposits, setting up structures of connections with banks around the territories and in the states. And then we had a president who was the 1800s equivalent of a certain president we just had. This was Andrew Jackson. He was an asshole. He was a son of a bitch. He was a genocidal murderer of Indians, Native Americans, and he was the common man's president. So what did he do? He sent federal troops in, and they attacked this national bank system, took the money out of it, and gave it to everyone. He was not going to be a part of any central bank nonsense. And that was about the end of it for a long time in the United States. There was not even much of a mention of anything like a central bank, even though the rest of the world was running along with central banks and doing a lot more things that would be what we consider to be modern as far as money transfers and deposits and all that. We weren't going to have any of that. As a matter of fact, by the time you get to the mid-1800s, the banking system was just a mess. It was, and after the Civil War, it got even worse with shysters and thieves and con men just tearing up the banking system with all their fraud and their schemes and their plots. And then there were sod banks, which would pop up in these Western towns, take people's money who wanted to deposit it for someplace safe to have it, and then they'd just leave town. The sod banks were just an absolute fiasco. Get into the 1870s, and you had more sophisticated scams and cons going on. If you were an honest banker, you didn't stand a chance against these con men and their schemes and their promises. Yeah, we're going to give you an interest rate that you can't believe. 25% on your money, you just put it with us, and we'll take care of it, make sure no one steals your money from and you go ahead and deposit your money with us. And they'd wear the dapper suits, and they'd have the cane and the silk tie, and they would convince people, and then they'd just disappear. Another scam that they did was with good banks. You see, banks need to keep some money that you deposit in their vault so that they can give it to you if you need it. Or if someone has a check that was written by you, it can be honored. So there's a reserve that banks, honest banks, would try to hold. Well, you see, that's a problem, though, because you don't want more people coming in for their money at once than you have on reserve. That would be called a run on the bank. And the bank, even though it was healthy, would just buckle right then. So what would the con men do? You know, I heard that bank over there that lady's running, it don't have any money for you. You heard that? Yeah, they're going to. And so you all run in there at the same time. Well, I don't have that much money. See, I told you. And she buckles, even though she was keeping a reasonably prudent deposit, a reserve. She couldn't handle it when I would create a run. And then her bank would fold, and I would just come in and buy it for pennies on the dollar. Tell you what, I'll let you get out of town, young lady, and then I'll take your money. Take over this bank. See, that ran into the 1920s. Well, you see, we knew this was going on, and it was getting to be such a problem in some cities with banks collapsing either through fraud of their own or through fraud of other people that it was actually having macroeconomic consequences. In other words, it's one thing when one bank fails, but when a whole bunch of banks are failing at the same time, that can actually crater the economy. We would have recessions that were insanely long compared. We bitch about a recession that's 4 quarters. We were talking that time of recessions would last years and years, part of it because of the fragility and the fraud in the banking system. Everyone knew something had to be done. I mean, lots of people. And the frauds weren't just in banking. I mean, there was a big problem with monopolies in the 1800s after the Civil War. These companies that would just control all of the supply and then they could jack the prices up whatever they wanted. So there were antitrust, there were what were called trusts, monopolies running, bank frauds running. And it's kind of a weird thing because this was still the era when the government was the best government money could buy. It was run by literally fat, white, old men smoking cigars in a back room deciding on everything from who was going to be elected to a judgeship to who was going to be elected president of the United States. It was all determined by these very powerful interests in back rooms. However, it got so bad that even in this era when money just essentially bought the government, that you even had antitrust, the first antitrust legislation was passed in 1890. It didn't work very well, but they came back around. By the time you get to the second decade of the 20th century, people were kind of getting a little sick of this crap, and you had what would be considered, even by sort of today's standards, a liberal administration of Woodrow Wilson came in the early 1900s, 1912. And they finally cracked down on the banking system. They passed a law in December of 1913 called the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve Act. This created the Federal Reserve System. You would be overseen by a board of governors appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. The board was seven governors and still is. Now, I'll try to trick you on a quiz and or on the final by saying there are seven governors and a chairman. No, the chairman is one of the governors, okay? It's the one is the top dog. Now, in recent years, you've had some that were very forceful, influential, powerful, and then you had some who were a little bit more, let's increase the money supply to help people, and others who said, no, 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 only control inflation. But the original charge of this Federal Reserve was three things. One was to regulate and supervise the banking system. Regulate and supervise. The second was that this Federal Reserve could serve as a bank for banks. Now, there are commercial banks, private commercial banks, that do this. And the Fed was told, you will set up and you will compete with these banks. You are not allowed to do predatory pricing or anything like that. And you must develop modern technologies at all times. And when you do, you have to share them with your private competitor banks. Which was actually how we've got things like ATMs, those magnetic strips on checks. All of that was because the Federal Reserve created those technologies, and then they shared them free of charge with all the other banks that offer banking services for banks. And then, this was the big one, conduct monetary policy. In other words, take the politics out of the money supply. See, if I'm a senator and I want everyone to reelect me, I'm going to say, I want you to run that printing press all night long, hand out money to everyone, everyone gets money, and then I'm going to tell all my constituents, I got you all the money that you want. Well, this said, no, you can't do that. The Federal Reserve must conduct monetary policy separate from politics and never get politics involved in it. What the frick? Okay. Unfortunately, in the 1970s, a fourth duty was put in there, that they would help the economy when it was in bad shape. That is in direct contradiction to this third point. In other words, the original Federal Reserve was there to control the price level. Do not print too much money because you'll create inflation. Do not print too little money because you'll create deflation. Maintain the money supply's growth at the real growth rate of the economy and it will be fine. Don't go helping. Unfortunately, by the 70s, they didn't. The senators who were in place and the presidents didn't get that. They didn't understand that having this fourth one was in direct contravention of the third one, hence where we are right now. Printing money like there's no tomorrow since 2017, and now we've got an inflation. Everyone's screaming and bitching about it because they don't get it. They don't understand that you can't just print money for COVID checks and extra benefits and all this kind of stuff and a ginormous military that fights wars on different fronts, at least not with money. If you're going to do it, you have to use taxes. Oh, God, we got to cut taxes. Well, whatever it is, you know, if we have a controlled money supply, you aren't going to get us to print money for you, so you got to figure out something else, cupcakes. Well, anyway, I'll get into this conduct monetary policy here in a minute. It has three different ways it can be done. One of them is kind of confusing. I won't beat you up with it on an exam. It should have been taught to you in your macroeconomics class, but I found out that's not what's going on there. Anyway, the Federal Reserve System divides the country into 12 districts. Each district has a district bank. Now, here where we are, we're actually not far from the boundary between the Chicago Fed and the St. Louis Fed. But each of these district banks has a district bank president. Now, this is important in just a minute here. 12 district bank presidents. They come into play here in just a minute. But, I mean, these district bank presidents are like the cream of the crop. These are people who are steeped in the details of finance, accounting, economics. They are highly educated, well-seasoned individuals. I've met two of them in my life, and they're just a different kind of person. I mean, I don't think they've ever had a traffic ticket. I don't even think they have sex, but they are like the top dog. Now, the Board of Governors, for a very long time, they were very similar. They were highly, highly respected, steeped in all of the details and the complexities of the financial world and the banking world. Unfortunately, that's not so much the case anymore. You've got more like political appointees. Some of the Fed governors, I mean, they had one. I can't remember whether it was Bush or Obama appointed one. She had been the president of a community bank that was so bad that when it was finally taken over, the new owners told her to leave. They'd give her some money if she never bothered them again. And then you've got one was a dinner theater actor or actress or something like that. So these board of governors have some dodgy characters in them anymore. But overall, they're still pretty good. But these bank presidents, they are the cream of the crop. As a matter of fact, I'll show you something here. Can you read this right here? What letter is that?
A J.
No, that's not.
Where?
Dude, right there, that ginormous F.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one. Okay, F would be, the hell, I can't read that. Here, read it. What's the F? What's the?
Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, this is Atlanta. Okay. So in other words, this one came out of the Bank of Atlanta. Now, the interesting thing about these is, see if I can find, would you like to try to read what's at the top of this? What's that thing say up there at the top?
Federal Reserve Note.
A Federal Reserve Note. Now, if you remember what I taught you earlier in the course, bills, bonds, notes, and all that, this is actually a debt instrument. This is a piece of this is an IOU. This is an IOU that the Federal Reserve creates. It buys government when the government needs money because it can't tax people enough. It borrows money. Some of that borrowing is from the Fed. It prints this to buy that debt from the government. And then it says, we owe you that money. And you know what they, and if you remember, a note is anywhere from about 2 to 7 years, 2 to 10 years. So what do they do when this thing matures? Well, they just shred it and print a couple more. So there's your way to be very comfortable in your life. Just borrow money, and then when it comes due, you just print more and give it to them, to the banks. But anyway, okay. So this kind of sets it up. Now, here's the thing, though. Regulate and supervise. The Board of Governors regulates. The district banks supervise. I will do that on a quiz or an exam. The board regulates. The banks supervise. Let me explain. You see, one problem in early law of our country and other countries was that the sovereign would pass laws, but how do you enforce a law? Well, okay, obviously you're going to need some kind of oversight to actually do that. Finally, in our country, it started in the 1800s, but it picked up steam in the 20th century. The government realized that if it passed laws, it was going to need an agency to oversee how those laws would be enforced. This is the way, for example, the Environmental Protection Agency was created to oversee the enforcement of environmental laws. The original antitrust laws, well, the problem was there wasn't an agency. So they had to go back, and in the 20th century, they created the Federal Trade Commission to oversee those laws. You see, the Board of Governors regulates. What they do is they take laws that are passed by the Congress and signed by the President, and they say, okay, we have this interpretation of that law. And then they promulgate that to the districts, enforce the law like this. Then the districts explain to the banks, this is how we are going to enforce these laws. And then the banks go and audit and do all that kind of stuff. Yes, and by the way, there are a surprising number of jobs in this business. If you're ever interested, there are a couple of employers. The Fed employs audit teams. There are other regulatory agencies. The Fed doesn't control all banks. They control only part of the banks. There's the Comptroller of the Currency. They are constantly coming here saying, you got anyone who'd like to become one of our audit, join an audit team? And I tell you, it sounds kind of boring, but the students who have gotten into this, they love it. And they make government money and all this kind of stuff. It's great. But anyway, so the board regulates its banks, the banks that are in the Federal Reserve System, and the districts handle all the banks in their area. We are in the Chicago Fed's district. So in other words, the Chicago Fed sends out teams that audit the Federal Reserve banks that are in the Federal Reserve System all through this area, clear up into Chicagoland, and I think they go over into Indiana and across to Wisconsin, I think. That district is relatively large. Here's the problem. When this was passed in the early 1900s, the districts on the East Coast were tiny because there was so much banking over there, but the districts on the West Side were enormous. Unfortunately, now the San Francisco Bank has an insane number of banks, and they're all in its category, all over this big part of the West. So it's kind of asymmetric right now. But anyway, that's how the Fed kind of works on its larger level. And this is a very big system. Let me say something about the bank for banks. Banks need a place to deposit their money. They have to do it somewhere. So it's basically the Federal Reserve System is one of the huge, huge banks. Yeah, you can deposit your money here, write checks off it here. That's essentially what a bank for banks does. There are huge private ones, commercial banks, that do this too. The Fed does it as well. The whole idea was that this system would never knock out the private commercial banks that do bank-for-bank services, but it competes against them. Someone asked me a few years ago, well, how many banks use the Federal Reserve and how many banks use, like, Citibank or something like that for their banking? I didn't know, and I called one of my former students from long ago down at the St. Louis Fed, and he said, well, in our district, it's about 60% of the banks use the Fed for their bank, and the rest use one commercial bank or another for their banking services. So it functions. It's not like the Fed's activity kills the other banks that do this. This would have been an incredibly successful model if we could have applied this to health insurance. Here's an agency of the government that will provide health insurance, but it's not allowed to destroy the private companies that provide health insurance. They work in competition with each other, making each other the best they can possibly be. But that was just too great an idea. To give you an idea of the bank-for-bank system, it has been successful for over a century, and every year the Fed's banking for banks produces enough money that it gives the Treasury several $1 billion in fees that it makes off its services to banks. That's how huge this is, and it just rolls on. Hardly anyone has any idea that this whole system works, a private and a government system, and they compete against each other, but they both seem to do quite well and survive in that environment. These 12 district banks, okay, now, here's the big one, conduct monetary policy. The Fed is supposed to grow the money supply, print these, at the rate at which the real economy is growing. In other words, provide enough lubrication that the economy can function, but not so much that there's an oversupply of money, which creates inflation, and not too little, which would cause the engine of the economy to freeze up. That's what the Fed is supposed to do. It's more or less almost a mathematical thing. Just grow the money supply at the real growth rate of the economy. We will not have inflations or deflations. In theory, yes, it works. In practice, it works. But then the Fed just can't stand it. It has to get involved. When the economy is slowing down, yeah, we'll print some more money. And then the inflation comes a little later. And then they say, uh-oh, we've got to contract the money supply to stop the inflation. Okay, whatever. Right now, we are in an inflationary period because we printed the money supply so aggressively that it just caused a nightmare. The last time we had something this bad was in the 1960s, we began to spend a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money. We still had high taxes at that time. 70% marginal tax bracket was the highest one. I mean, that by today's standards, you'd see a lot of politicians screaming from the rooftops about that. But back then, we had good, strong taxes, collecting a lot of money that way. But we also had ambitions. The president in 1961 who came in, Jack Kennedy, I was absolutely committed to technological revolution. We are going to put a man on the moon by the end of this century, that kind of stuff. Okay, well, wonderful. Well, the problem was that required money. And we are going to fight a war on poverty. Okay, that's going to take money. And oh, God, he and his brother, they hated communists like a passion, and they went after them. We are going to put advisors in this country called Vietnam, and we are going to stop the domino effect across Asia. The communists will be stopped there. So we had a theater war that blew out of control in Vietnam. So we were spending money, and sure enough, eventually the Fed started printing to help with the tax revenues to fund the government. And then we had a real disaster in 1973, I think it was. the Arabs got really pissed off at us because we were financing their sworn enemy, Israel, and so they cut off the oil supply, the OPEC oil embargo. So we had to print money to make people happy with that disaster. By the time we were finished, by the end of the 70s, inflation was insane and out of control. And of course, the president who was in power, he appointed a Federal Reserve chairman who would crush the money supply, get the liquidity overhang out, threw us into a recession. That president was kicked out of office in 1980. President Jimmy Carter was kicked out by Ronald Reagan. And so, but the Fed chairman was still there, and he kept the money supply going down until we got rid of the inflation. Okay, that sets the stage. But how does the Fed conduct monetary policy? Here's the funniest thing about it. Telling you this story is like telling you about a magic wind that is completely driving the economy, and hardly anyone knows that this is happening, and it happens on a day-to-day basis. The three tools of monetary policy. There's one that's kind of blunt. The one that's blunt is the required reserve ratio. The Fed says how much money a bank must keep in its vaults to satisfy demand deposits. 5%, 10%, whatever. As it increases that required reserve ratio, the banks don't have as much money to lend out to boost the economy. The Fed doesn't use this one very much at all because it's like a meat axe. As a matter of fact, right after 9/11, there was a big concern that people were going to freak out and run their banks. So the Fed jacked up the required reserve ratio on banks so that they'd have lots of money in their vaults in case there were runs on the banks. Oddly enough, the run didn't happen. But there's that. The next tool is the discount rate. The Fed sets a rate at which it will lend money to banks if they need money, The banks can borrow at the discount window at that rate. If the Fed lifts that rate up, it's sort of like a message to the economy, slow down. If the Fed lowers that rate, it's a message to the economy and to the banks, speed up. Interestingly enough, banks don't have to borrow from the Fed. They can borrow from each other. There's this giant, vast pool of all the money the banks have in reserve. It's called the federal funds. It's like trillions of dollars. Banks can go there and borrow from each other. Now, the Fed can't control that rate. The Fed cannot set that rate. It's a supply and demand thing. They can try to aim something. They can say, well, we're going to drain money out of the system. That'll make the rate go up. Or they can inject money and the rate will go down. But this federal funds rate is not set by the Fed. You will see so many times in the news media, in financial markets, well, the Fed set the federal funds rate at, no, they didn't, they can't. They can say where they want it to go, and they can pull money out and push money in to get it like where they want it, but they can't set that federal funds rate. Know this, on a test, I may try to ask you, say something. Well, the Federal Reserve sets the discount rate and the federal funds rate. No, they set only the discount rate. And you'll see this in that video, too. This is the nasty one. The Fed every day conducts open market operations, OMOs. Billions of dollars every day. The Fed has a giant desk. It's actually floors in New York City. The New York Fed, the New York District Bank Control does this, where traders have T-bills and they have cash money. And they'll just simply go to banks and they'll say, if they want to add money to the economy, they'll say, Mr. Banker, will you please sell us some of your T-bills in your reserves? Because banks can keep T-bills, they're safe. And if the banks say yes, then the Fed sends them money and takes the T-bills back to itself. That adds to the money supply. But the Fed could also do it the other way. The traders could say, okay, we want to get money out of the economy, so we're going to call banks and we're going to say, we want to sell you T-bills. You send us money and we'll send you T-bills. And that would drain money out of the economy. That would drain that federal funds pool. Billions of dollars every day is flowing like this. This is how the ebb and the flow of the economy is driven. That's what's happening right now. The Fed, there's this massive liquidity overhang, all this extra money in the economy. So what the Fed is doing is every day calling banks and saying, you got T-bills, we want to sell you some more. And the banks say, well, okay. And then the Fed sends them T-bills, and the banks send them money back. So that contracts the money supply. And that's why we're slipping toward a recession. It's because as the money supply goes down, the price of money, interest rates, goes up. That's the whole idea of open market operations in a nutshell. It's, in practice, it's actually a little more complicated than this, but in a class that's only 50 minutes long, I wouldn't beat you up with the details of it. But know this, this is how the whole system works. And this is what's moving the economy right now and always. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.